Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call Media Roundtable. We begin today's show by discussing abortion rights in the United States. If the leaked Supreme Court opinion does not change, the decision that protects the right to an abortion will be overturned. The legality of abortion services will then be determined on a state-by-state basis. 26 states are certain or likely to immediately ban abortion, according to the Guttmacher Institute. At least 7 states have passed bans with no exceptions for rape or incest. They include Missouri, Arkansas, and Texas. In several polls, 70% of the public say Roe should not be overturned. That is 70%. And yet so many in the media are still calling abortion the most divisive issue of our time. So how did we get here? Well, both sides' media stories, gerrymandering, the Electoral College, 4 of the justices who've signed on to the leaked opinion were appointed by presidents who did not win the popular vote, the power of the religious right, voter suppression, and dark money. One example about dark money, according to The Guardian, an extreme group called Students for Life of America is co-chaired by Leonard Leo, the conservative lawyer who served for years at the helm of the Federalist Society and was the legal advisor to Donald Trump, who appointed ultra-conservatives to the highest court in the land. Records show that the group Students for Life of America had a budget of about $20,000 in 2004 and $12 million in 2019. Yet most media outlets that quote people with Students for Life of America do not include this information. The group's longtime executive director, Kristen Hawkins, has said in her ideal world, the pill and IUDs would be illegal. She was recently on MSNBC with not one question about funding. She also lied about statistics many times with no pushback. Again, 70% of the public say Roe should not be overturned. And when extreme bans go to the voters, even in conservative states, they almost always lose. Joining us to talk about these issues are two guests. Megan Winter is a magazine writer who has covered abortion for many outlets. Megan Winter is the author of All Politics is Local, Why Progressives Must Fight for the States. Hi, Megan. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We're also joined by Amy Littlefield, an abortion access correspondent for The Nation and a contributor for Reveal. Amy Littlefield focuses on reproductive rights, healthcare, and religion. Hi, Amy. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, Rose. It's great to be with you.
Well, great to have both of you. This is a really tough question to answer, but do you think there's any possibility that this leaked Supreme Court opinion will change? Because we are expected to get the official opinion next month. What are your thoughts, Amy?
I guess there's a remote possibility that this could change, but I read the draft as soon as it came out. It looks pretty well reasoned, at least if you're Samuel Alito, maybe it seems well reasoned and it looks pretty thorough. And I think most experts believe that this is what we're going to see, which, you know, frankly, many people, especially grassroots activists in abortion hostile states, have been expecting and preparing for months, if not years, since Trump was allowed to fill 3 vacancies on the Supreme Court. And so, you know, I think I've been focusing on speaking with activists and abortion providers in communities that are going to be impacted by this. And I think everyone is functioning on the assumption that this draft is real and that planning has to proceed accordingly.
Right. And this week, just a couple days ago, Chief Justice Roberts confirmed the authenticity of the leaked draft. And Megan, what would you add?
Yeah, I agree with Amy. And I think if there are any changes that, and I'm sure there'll be some sort of changes made in revision, but the main point is that Roe will be overturned, whether it's overturned in such brazen language or whether it's overturned in slightly modified language, really doesn't matter. The central thing that matters is that abortion access will diminish, and then states will have much more leeway, not only to ban abortion, but to potentially and probably criminalize providing abortions. And, you know, who knows where we're going from here. So I think, you know, the conversation about the draft itself, I think, is much less important than, you know, those questions about what's going to happen to people who are pregnant. And I love the way you set up the section about funding and the broader, you know, political context. I think those are the important questions to be thinking about.
Right. So let's dive in, and we have time. There's a lot to talk about when we look at how the media have covered abortion over the years. I mean, the one thing that stands out for me, and I just Googled the most divisive issue of our time, it still is being printed everywhere from CNBC to the New York Times. So, Megan, what explains that? 70% of the public say Roe should not be overturned, and yet this is called the most divisive issue of our time.
It's a hard one, but I'm going to do my best. I think one of the important things that has shaped the way that abortion is discussed or not discussed is that people who are anti-abortion, especially the activists, see this in such black and white terms and have been so motivated to go to great lengths to not only pour millions of dollars into organizations like the Federalist Society, but also on the ground, show up every weekend at clinics and scream and hold, you know, posters with all kinds of grotesque imagery, et cetera. It's been a, you know, very black and white, very passionate issue, whereas the abortion rights position tends to be defined or has been over the years defined much more by nuance. If you talk to people who support abortion rights, it's by definition almost a much more nuanced position. And so I think that has somewhat played into how galvanized each camp has been. And we're seeing this changing, you know, in ways now where abortion rights opponents are much more framing their arguments around justice and around really emotional and evocative, you know, things. But I think that's played into it. And so that's one aspect. And we could talk about this forever, but, and I think another is, and I'm curious what Amy thinks. And, you know, I think part of it also is because this debate has been going on in different ways since the 70s, I think it's a little bit of a, you know, assigning editors or people writing headlines or whatever are sort of in a rote mode where they continue to fall into that same way of thinking rather than actually looking at the new context that we're in, you know, where the guideline, what's happening with our democracy has changed, right, in recent years. But I don't necessarily know or think that people making decisions at outlets are putting abortion in that new context. They're falling upon the same tropes that this conversation has been in for 30 or 40 years. Amy, I'm super curious what you think about that.
I think that's so right, Megan. And I also, I mean, a plug for Megan's book, okay? Anyone who wants to deeply understand how we got to the point where we are today needs to read All Politics is Local, because it really outlines how the funding piece and the decision by progressives to underinvest in state battles has been so central to this, because that's where the fight has been on the issue of abortion. And I think another reason why this falsely looks like a contentious issue when it's really not is that you have such lopsided rhetoric when it comes to the Republican versus the Democratic Party, right? I mean, you have a Republican Party that since the 80s has wholeheartedly embraced abortion as almost a singular issue, right, that can help Republicans rise to power in states to, you know, enact new legislative maps that help them continue to keep their grasp on power, that allow them to then erode voting rights and a whole range of other issues, because they see it as opportunistically as an issue that can allow them to rile up a certain segment of their base. Whereas I think Democrats over time, I mean, especially in the 1990s under Clinton, you know, when they referred to abortion as safe, legal, and rare, right, have really been more defensive, more tentative, and have spoken about abortion in a way that doesn't activate, you know, the majority that support legal abortion. And so I think that, you know, and we're seeing that play out now, right, where Biden is sort of evading questions about whether to end the filibuster and how to protect Roe in this historic moment of loss for abortion rights. So, so I think that's a key component. I think also I'll just say, you know, there's a tremendous amount of energy and motivation and brilliance within the grassroots movement to preserve abortion access. And a huge amount of that energy is being funneled into the massive logistics operation that is underway to get people to the waning number of abortion clinics in this country. So I think there's a lot of activism that is totally invisible because it's people, you know, spending an hour on the phone calling hotels and booking flights and buying bus tickets just to get, you know, one patient from Missouri to Chicago or from Texas to New Mexico in order to shore up abortion access.
Well, let's spend a little bit of time talking about the Republicans and their very close connection with these extreme religious groups. Then we'll talk about Democrats, and then we can talk about how this is actually going to affect women and girls. And we're also going to do three shows about this next week. So last week we did a show about the dark money behind the anti-LGBTQ bills, the anti-CRT bills, the quote school choice bills, and how there are a handful of major funders that a lot of us know about, maybe three or four, and then so many smaller groups that many of us have never heard of, but they all are in line with their end goal. And so the Kochs, for example, a lot of us have heard of the Koch brothers, and they are funding a lot of groups like the Independent Women's Forum, for example, a number of other extreme anti-choice groups. And according to True North Research, Charles Koch supports reproductive rights, but the politicians he supports are anti-choice. And according to this group, Koch sought to unite social and economic conservatives to push for his tax cuts and anti-regulation agenda, which has meant supporting vehemently anti-abortion candidates and organizations like the Susan B. Anthony List or Concerned Women of America. So, Megan, when you look at it, I mean, they've done a really incredible job of sticking together for their end goal.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. It should be pointed out that within the anti-abortion movement, there are, you know, numerous different factions who have pushed for different strategies and et cetera. But the underlying point that, you know, these libertarian donors, a lot of corporate donors who may or may not agree with this social values of these, especially state lawmakers, have nonetheless supported them and gotten them into office primarily because that serves their own purposes. I think it's really important, especially because we're in a redistricting year right now, to point out that a lot of these state anti-abortion bills that we've seen in the past several years, including this Mississippi bill, which is the Dobbs case that we're all discussing, a lot of those started escalating after 2010. And why is that? That's because right before that year, around 2009, a bunch of Republican operatives got together with corporate donors, and they realized that if they flipped these state houses across the country, then they were going to have incredible power, not only to pass various bills on things like energy or abortion, but also because they were going to be able to control the levers of democracy, right? Like the voting bills that we've seen, most of those go through state houses as well. And then they could redistrict, and or they could control redistricting with gerrymandering. So that had huge consequences, that 2010 election. There are a number of, so many different interest groups have invested in those state elections over the years because they're relatively inexpensive to flip the seat. So this is something that Republicans and various interest groups knew to invest in, whereas Democrats and progressives, you know, did not. So that is something that we all should be thinking about. And I could go on about this forever, but I'll stop myself there. But yeah, for sure, donors have poured money into these races. And I think it's interesting, you know, I saw something last night about different companies that are now going to pay for their employees who are living in red states to travel out of state to obtain, you know, healthcare abortions if they live in a state where it will soon be banned or criminalized. And on one hand, you know, I think that's a good thing to do for their employees. But on the other hand, these same corporations have donated to the election of these lawmakers, and who are at the same time suppressing voting rights so that it's very hard to even get them out of office. So these are all the kinds of ways in which abortion should be reported, where we're seeing it in the context of much larger political decisions and longer term strategies. And then I will stop talking in just a second, but I just want to like hugely underline and highlight what Amy said a few minutes ago about Democrats. Like Republicans and these strategists have been thinking 10 or 20, 30 years ahead of time, whereas Democrats and progressives have so often been reactive. And we are seeing this again in this moment where it does not seem to me that Democrats have, from what I can tell, like a strong, a plan for how they're going to get providers out of the situation, how they're going to get, you know, how they're going to advocate all of this. It seems like no one has really thought this through or thought of a strategy.
And one more point on the power of gerrymandering at the state level, Megan, and how these extreme Republicans have won office. Just for a little bit of history, this is so important. In 2006 and 2008, South Dakota politicians supported legislation that would have nearly banned all abortions. But when the bill went to the voters as a ballot initiative, they lost. And then in 2011, Mississippi voters rejected an amendment to the state constitution that would have outlawed abortion by defining a fertilized egg as a person. So they learned that when you take these extreme bans to the people, they do not pass. And so they realized, in order for us to get this passed, we've got to do it. We can't take it to the people.
Absolutely. No, I'm so glad you brought that up. Because something that I found frustrating, if we're going to, you know, stick on the media coverage, something that I find really frustrating is this framing of returning it to the states. And there's an anti-abortion groups will often make the argument that this is a fair thing to do, because I mean, it is true that if we did live in a truly representative democracy, you know, then those state legislators would vote to reflect the will of the people in their states. And that, if you take that argument at face value, it does seem like that's democratic and fair. However, we know that, I mean, one, constitutional rights should not be decided by what, you know, people's neighbors, they're enshrined by, you know, the Constitution, one. But two, we don't have fair representation. So going back to the states, because of redistricting, because of gerrymandering, I mean, I can give you the example of Florida, where there's roughly the same number of registered Democrats and Republicans in the state. And yet the state, their legislature is very Republican. I forget if it's a supermajority or close to it. And that's because of gerrymandering. So even if it is returned to the states, it's returned to a decision where Republicans have a lock on power for the foreseeable future. And so it's not a genuine moment of people being able to vote someone out if they do vote against abortion rights. Right. So I think that's really important for people to understand, to really look closely at those arguments about state rights, which we could talk about again forever, but you know, it's a disingenuous argument. And most of the people who are making it know that because they have helped create this plan.
Right. Amy, what would you add?
I think that's so right. I mean, look at the fact that in Texas, where, you know, residents have been living under a 6-week abortion ban for the past 8 months, you know, a majority of Texans oppose that. And so the will of the people has been overridden by the way that elections take place and the way that electoral maps are drawn in that state, added to the fact that, you know, there's been an underinvestment in it, in the state of Texas, you know, and an underinvestment in groups that, you know, are working locally, but are really under-resourced in trying to promote abortion access in the state. So I think, you know, Megan's spot on about that. And yeah, I mean, and just thinking about like the language that Justice Alito used in his decision, right? Saying, or in his draft decision, saying, you know, that he's returning the issue to the duly elected representatives in the state, and how sort of disingenuous that is when you take into account the fact that a majority of Americans support maintaining Roe in place. And in his very decision overruling that, Alito is claiming to be returning it to the majority. So I think that's absolutely right.
Amy Littlefield is an abortion access correspondent for The Nation and a contributor for Reveal. Amy focuses on reproductive rights, healthcare, and religion. Megan Winter is a magazine writer who has covered abortion for many outlets and is the author of All Politics is Local: Why Progressives Must Fight for the States. If you have any thoughts about media coverage of abortion, with 70% supporting Roe, and the media calling this a very divisive issue, the country's divided on this, we'd love to hear from you. You can email yourcall@kalw.org or call us 866-798-8255. Just another media question for both of you, because this is so important, and I want to make sure we get to this before we have to end the segment. Margaret Sullivan, who writes about the media for the Washington Post, had a piece with a great headline: "The Media Fell for Pro-Life Rhetoric and Helped Create This Mess." And Margaret Sullivan starts the piece by talking about her first child, who was delivered by Shalom Press, who is the father of the journalist Eyal Press, who we've had on our show. And so Eyal Press knows a lot about this issue because of who his father is, and I'm sure he's also very interested in it. He said, "The media really normalized the term pro-life to discuss people who oppose abortion. In reality, Republicans are anything but pro-life. For example, the right has not supported strong gun control measures despite the increasing prevalence of school shootings, nor has it shown much dismay over high infant and maternal mortality rates, especially for poor women and children." So, Amy, what are your thoughts about this whole term pro-life and how the media have just used this for so long?
I think that's right. And I mean, the sort of both sidesism tendency in the media, I think, has really been a false framing for this particular conversation. I mean, when you look at it, 1 in 4 women, and an untold number of non-binary and trans people as well, have had abortions, right? So this is a deeply personal issue. And for some people, it's a really complicated issue. For some people, it's really not, right? But I do think that the framing of it has, as pro-life versus pro-choice, has belied the fact that this is really a Christian right agenda that has to do with, you know, as you pointed out with regard to Kristen Hawkins, and I've been attending a lot of anti-abortion, you know, meetings and forums recently to sort of listen in on what they're thinking about as far as their next steps. I mean, make no mistake, they want to ban birth control. You know, they want to ban same-sex marriage, right? They want a reassertion of the, you know, place at the center of society for the white, patriarchal, heterosexual family. And it's that agenda fused very closely and very effectively with the agenda of a Republican Party that has been, you know, focused on not just banning abortion and using that as sort of the tip of the spear to rise to power, as Megan points out, but also eroding the social safety net and taking away the very protections that would help people raise their families in a healthy society. And so I think it really is that fusion of the Republican parties. You know, I mean, why would someone like the Koch brothers support, you know, this agenda? I mean, again, it has to do with that fusion of the pro-corporate, you know, anti-social safety net Republican Party with the Christian right, this opportunistic sort of fusion with the Christian right. And frankly, the abortion rights movement just has not gotten the same traction within the Democratic Party. And I think we're seeing the consequences of that play out now.
Okay, so then another question that we have been grappling with: how do you think the media should deal with interviewing these people? And if they do bring on, for example, Kristen Littlefield, and just to remind listeners, I'm sorry, Kristen Hawkins,
No relation
to Amy Littlefield. Sorry about that. Kristen Hawkins runs the extreme group called Students for Life of America. They've raised $12 million in 2019. She said in her ideal world, the pill should be illegal. She was on MSNBC recently. She lied many times. There was no pushback. And then on 1A, a couple days ago, Oklahoma Representative Jim Olson said, quote, there is a case for appropriate welfare programs in certain situations, but the overall responsibility is up to the parents. People need to make decisions before the clothes come off. So, Megan, what are your thoughts? I mean, I know we're talking about TV and radio right now, but how should these extreme conservatives be, I guess, dealt with in the media? Should they be given a voice? And if so, how should it be handled?
Yeah, I think this is a really important thing to think about. You know, it takes so much context to understand, to be able to distinguish between a false claim and a piece of information. One quick point is, I think that if media outlets had taken abortion seriously 10 years ago or 20 years ago, rather than a quote women's issue or some sort of side fringe political conversation, we all, or at least people in the media, would have been more prepared for how much disinformation there is and how it infects our politics. Because this has been happening for years and years within the anti-abortion movement. A quick story I remember, I was on, I don't remember even what the show was, but some NPR style show with an anti-abortion activist. And I told the producer ahead of the show, I don't want to be in a back and forth where I'm arguing with this person. You know, I don't want to be, you know, I don't want to be doing that. But the anti-abortion activist made a claim that I knew was false about the safety of abortion. They claimed that abortion was dangerous, which it is not. First trimester abortion is extremely safe. It's much safer than carrying a pregnancy to term. And so when the person made the false claim, I said that it was false, which is the role of a journalist and a person speaking in public. Like, that is our role. And the host of the radio show, who's a man, immediately said to me, oh, so now you're taking a side, as if saying a medical fact was taking a side in the more political or philosophical part of the debate, which it should not be. So, and I think those kinds of things, you know, have been rampant in the coverage of abortion. And, you know, that, I mean, it speaks for itself, that kind of thing. So in terms of what I think people should do, I mean, now I'll plug Amy. It's like, have people like Amy on, who spent time at conferences, who knows that the anti-abortion movement is about establishing a theocracy, who knows the medical information, so that when someone, you know, is saying propaganda that they're saying very confidently, that they made themselves actually believe because they heard it from someone else that they trust, that reporter who knows the entire context or much of the context can say, no, that's not what's true. But, you know, that this spirals us into a whole larger conversation about disinformation and trust and all of that. But I think it's really important. On one hand, I think it's really important to have the voices of anti-abortion or all kinds of activists who believe, you know, fringe views and or who have political power, because we do need to know what those people believe and what they want. But it is so they do need to be given space to say those things out loud. But unless people push back on them or ask them really hard questions, it is just giving propaganda airtime. And that is really dangerous. So I think, you know, it take, and this is a whole other larger conversation about the decline of local journalism, like these state house papers and places that could do, who knew these lawmakers day in and day out. They had the full context of who they represented and, you know, the tenor on the ground. Like, those kinds of reporters are fewer and farther in between and are stretched much farther. National reporters who are not covering this as a very specific beat, like, for example, the way Amy is, don't have the full context to understand how this has played out for the past 40 years. And I think it's much harder for those reporters to distinguish a talking point from something that is true.
Amy, what are your thoughts on this?
I think that's right. I mean, I think reporters have to be really, really prepared. I mean, just for an example of some of the more egregious misinformation we've seen coming out in recent days, you know, lawmakers, state lawmakers saying, well, we should, you know, be protecting ectopic pregnancies. You know, we should, you know, it's murder to end an ectopic pregnancy. Well, if you don't know that an ectopic pregnancy is a pregnancy that is doomed because it's implanted in the fallopian tube, and that if it continues growing, it's going to rupture, and that person carrying it is probably going to hemorrhage and die. You know, that you have to be informed about this sort of, and I think broadly speaking, a lot of the American public and the media included is not informed on information like that. I also think it's the case that the anti-abortion movement has just been really effective at the way that it's used its version of purported facts to advance its agenda and to set up this sort of false debate as if the evidence and the scientific information here is really in dispute. Mm-hmm. And I think Megan's example is a really, you know, is sort of the epitome of that, right? Of claiming that abortion is dangerous when all of the data show that that's not the case and that it's far safer than childbirth. I think that, you know, many years ago, a lot of people within the anti-abortion movement realized, and I know this because I've spoken with them, they realized that religion in and of itself was not necessarily going to be a winning argument that would help them, you know, win over people who maybe were unsure about abortion. And so they really made a concerted effort to invest in trying to co-opt the facts and to sort of give this veneer of scientific legitimacy to a lot of their claims. I worked on an hour-long show recently for Reveal about this very effort and how they have created, for example, the Charlotte Lozier Institute, which is an anti-abortion, you know, think tank that produces information that, you know, sort of their answer to the Guttmacher Institute, right? Mm-hmm. And so it can be really effective because, for example, when you look at the 6-week abortion ban in Texas, right? They call it a heartbeat bill because they claim they're banning abortion when an embryo has a beating heart. Well, that's medically inaccurate, right? Like we talk to experts who say that's not a heart yet. It's, you know, a vibrating clump of cells that's developing. But what just happened? You know, I had that conversation on their terms. I engaged with this idea of an embryo having a beating heart. And I forgot about, you know, if you have the discussion about that, you forget about the person carrying it. You forget about their hopes and dreams and the fact that they're having to travel hundreds of miles. And, you know, the idea that they might be forced to carry a pregnancy that they don't want. And so it changes the terms of the debate. And I think when reporters engage with sort of the fact-checking the claims without looking at the wider stakes, without bringing in people who've had abortions and their perspective, it really limits and distorts the conversation.
That is Amy Littlefield, abortion access correspondent for The Nation and a contributor for Reveal. Megan Winter is a magazine writer who covers abortion and is the author of All Politics is Local. We are getting a lot of comments, so let's take a couple callers in a row, and then we'll get responses from our guests. Let's hear from Judy in San Francisco. Hi, Judy. Thanks for holding.
Thank you. Thank you so much. You know, I'm a little confused because I've been following these, you know, social conservative organizing, the organizing that's been done on the right with social issues, and I think that I'm very cynical about it. I think that they've just been used to get votes. But if 70% of people are somewhat are for Roe versus Wade, I don't really understand the advantage anymore of these right-wingers who don't really care and give a damn about abortion or fetuses or anything, or certainly women. You know, I don't understand the advantage of them still hewing to this cause. Can you explain that?
Yeah, thank you, Judy. We'll get a response in just a minute. Let's go to a few more callers, Kate in Berkeley. Hi, Kate. Thank you for holding.
Okay, I would like to talk about a film called Birthright, which has been ignored by the media pretty much. It deals with the issue that reproductive issues have already been criminalized. Women in the South particularly have been criminalized for having situations which using reproductive rights, and I can cite a couple of cases if you like, but are in the film Birthright, which really identified a few years ago all of these sort of criminalizations of women who had reproductive issues, not necessarily abortion. And these women went to jail, had their babies taken away, had to fight legal and court cases. And that those issues have not been discussed at all in relationship to these particular things going on now.
Well, thank you for that. Birthrightfilm.com. We will look into this and possibly do a show about this. They say this is the real life Handmaid's Tale and we are fighting back. Thank you so much for that recommendation, Kate. Let's go to Mary in San Francisco. Hi, Mary.
Thank you for taking my call. And I wanted to bring a piece of legislation to your attention and your guests called the Safe Banking Act, co-sponsored by Senator Alex Padilla and 20 other U.S. senators, including Bernie Sanders, I believe. One of the challenges facing states that will be allowing abortion will be banking, and the fact that the banks cannot handle money under felonies under federal law. What the Safe Banking Act does is to provide a mechanism by which an abortion care provider and their patients can have access to banking services, even if abortion is a felony under federal law. There are also other options such as community and public banking. So I wanted to bring that aspect, and also a quick critique of media coverage of reproductive rights and abortion issue, of not making enough intersections with marijuana prohibition and the fact of having to travel to another state, a woman leaving Alabama to come to California so she can have medicine for her child with epilepsy, people losing Section 8 housing. Now the RICO Act, look out for that with pills going across interstate lines. Oh. I've been committing felonies for over a half a century now.
Mary, sorry to cut you off. We're almost out of time, but you bring up such an important point about interstate lines. And, you know, some states want to make it illegal for women or girls to cross state lines to get an abortion. I mean, there's so many other aspects of this, and we're going to get into all of that next week. Final thoughts from both of you to Judy's question. What is the motivation for pursuing these extreme bans when 70% of the public support Roe? Megan, what are your thoughts?
So I think this gets to the heart of a major issue, which is that because rural voters who tend to be white and conservative are overrepresented in our state legislatures and Congress, because of gerrymandering and disproportionate representation, they don't have to speak to the general public often to keep their seats. They have to speak to the minority of Americans. And we live in that's why we, generally, I think democracy reform and thinking about how to change that so people have more representation is an extremely important part of so many social causes, including abortion rights.
Amy, your thoughts?
I think that's absolutely right. And I think the other piece that we need to keep in mind is that Republicans are starting to shift and broaden and have been for many years their lens in the culture wars, right? And you brought up, you know, critical race theory that's playing out, you know, at the school district level, at the city council level, right? We're seeing these attempts to criminalize and punish transgender kids and their families who support them. This is all part of the same agenda that, as Megan said, is geared towards riling up strategically a particular part of the white conservative rural base, and that is opposed by the vast majority of people in this country.
Well, we are going to do 3 shows next week about these issues, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. So I hope you can join us for those shows. Megan Winter is a magazine writer who has covered abortion for many outlets and is the author of All Politics is Local, Why Progressives Must Fight for the States. Megan, thank you so much for joining us.
It's an honor. Thank you for having me.
Amy Littlefield is an abortion access correspondent for The Nation and a contributor for Reveal, who focuses on reproductive rights. Amy, thank you so much for joining us and thanks for your work.
Thank you so much. Always a pleasure.
Thank you. Coming up after a break, we will talk about the plight of Ukrainian refugees. So many are deciding to return, and we'll find out why that is the case. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We'll be back after this.